Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen, senior reporter in the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom, filling in for Brian, who's off today. On today's show, we'll unpack Governor Kathy Hochul's budget proposal with an eye on what it means for the city. It's a $227 billion plan with some surprising policy proposals embedded in it. Then, a conversation about caring for our elders financially and what that means for the choices we make today. Plus, six more weeks of winter. It's Groundhog Day. 30 years since that movie became shorthand for those loops in life we just cannot break out of. We ask you to call in with what feels like Groundhog Day in your life. But first, he's been in office for less than a month officially, but Congressman Dan Goldman has been busy. A Democrat, he's the freshman member of the new 10th Congressional District, a product of last year's wild redistricting cycle. The district stretches from Lower Manhattan across to the neighborhoods along the North Brooklyn waterfront. Goldman was the winner of a very crowded primary that included several current and former elected officials. Part of the case he made to voters was that he could bring his skills as a former federal prosecutor to serve as a check on what was expected to be an even more Republican-controlled Congress. Goldman is no stranger to Washington, D.C. He served as lead prosecutor in the first impeachment investigation of former President Trump. And since the start of this 118th Congress, he has been an outspoken critic of another member of the New York congressional delegation. That would be Republican Congressman George Santos from Queens and Long Island. Joining me now to talk about his work both in Washington and here at home is Congressman Dan Goldman. Congressman, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Bridget. Great to be here.
And listeners, particularly those of you in the 10th Congressional District, our phones are open. What are your questions about this new Congress, some of the work Congressman Goldman will be doing on the committees he's assigned to, which we're going to talk about? And is there any issue in the district that you want to ask about or put on his radar? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Congressman, as I said, you have been busy on a lot of fronts. And before we talk about Congressman Santos, I want to start with your oversight work. And in this case, oversight with a lowercase o, since that's what you're doing writ large through your office. But just yesterday, as a member of the House Oversight Committee, capital O, you were part of a hearing that the Republican majority said would target pandemic-era spending fraud. Can you tell us a little about yesterday's hearing and how you approached the hearing in a different way?
Sure. You know, I think when you have these large appropriations from Congress, which, you know, happened after the 2008 financial crisis as well, you are going to have bad actors who prey on the opportunity to defraud the government in these programs. And there's no question that we have seen that because of the unprecedented nature and of this pandemic and the Congress's truly, you know, remarkable effort to not only save lives, but save the economy during the shutdown. You had a number of bad actors who did defraud the government in the PPP program and in the other programs that Congress appropriated. And so in theory, having, you know, some oversight from the Oversight Committee of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse is a legitimate function of the Oversight Committee. Mm-hmm. But as with all things in this Republican Congress, that wasn't exactly how they approached it, nor was it the purpose of the hearing, notwithstanding the name. And so, you know, I thought it was important for us as Democrats to point out what is merited for oversight and why this sort of partisan blame game is unhelpful and frankly just incorrect. And so, you know, when you look at the pandemic response, you know, the initial wave of money happened during the Trump administration, and much of the problems stemmed from the Trump administration. And I think that the Biden administration has done an admirable job, not only in cracking down on fraud, but in making sure that the federal government is working much more for the people. And so we tried to bring that perspective to this hearing.
You were also tapped to serve on the Select Committee on Weaponization of the Federal Government that will be chaired by Congressman Jim Jordan. It's been described as, quote, a sweeping new Select Committee that will review misconduct by the federal government. You have called it the GOP subcommittee to obstruct justice. What do you view as your role on that committee?
Right. It is that because it is a sweeping jurisdiction for this subcommittee, including the authority to investigate ongoing criminal investigations, which is a very transparent way of trying to interfere in the Department of Justice's ongoing investigations into Donald Trump and even into some of the House Republicans themselves. And so what I'm hoping to bring to that committee is, based on my 10 years working for the Department of Justice alongside the FBI and my work as a staff member on the House Intelligence Committee, where I interacted with the intelligence community on a daily basis, is to bring some facts and truth to what is almost certainly going to be overreaching and partisan investigative effort by Jim Jordan. I sat across from Jim Jordan for 17 depositions during the impeachment investigation, and I got to know him and his tactics. And I think what we as Democrats are going to do is bring a very sober, serious approach to making sure that we defend our institutions of democracy, that we defend the rule of law, and that we actually bring some expertise about how the federal government works. And that is not something that the Republican members, including Jim Jordan, seem to understand very well. So, you know, I view my job in part is to make sure that the Department of Justice, the executive agencies that are trying to be a bulwark for democracy, are defended in the sense of what their jobs are and what they're doing, and making sure that we understand and the American people truly understand how our government works for the people, not in a partisan way that the Republicans will bring.
We're going to go to one of our callers. Let's go to Andrew in Middle Village. Andrew, you are on the line with Congressman Dan Goldman.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Congressman Golden, yeah, I just actually have three questions, but I'll keep to two. When are you going to audit the Pentagon? In other words, all that money that is poured into the military-industrial complex, a ton of it is not accounted for. Up to $2 trillion has been lost. When are you going to audit specifically the monies that have been sent to Ukraine to fund a war? And when are you going to call for diplomacy to end that war? Because that is the only way that that war is going to end. And when is this country going to stop being involved in endless wars?
Thanks for the question, Andrew. You know, I think we as, you know, on the, at least I am concerned about the growing spending that is occurring with our defense budget, which continues to increase, you know, every year, notwithstanding the fact that the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars are over. And I think you raise a very good point that will probably come up as the Republicans insist on cutting spending. And they are traditionally going to want to cut spending for domestic programs, including Social Security and Medicare, which we as Democrats are going to vigorously defend. But we are going to insist on some cuts in defense spending to be comparable to any cuts that occur in domestic spending. But I think you raise an issue, which frankly is something I want to bring, which is oversight and accountability to all government programs, both federally, but also within the district and within the city, making sure that we are doing the proper oversight and holding NYCHA accountable, for example. Yes, we need a lot of funding for NYCHA capital improvement, but we also need to make sure that our NYCHA residents are living with dignity and living with heat and hot water and basic needs. And that's something that all too often NYCHA is failing to do. So oversight and accountability as in the minority is going to be something that we can still effectively do, even if it's going to be hard to pass our legislative priorities.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Brian, who's out today, and my guest is Congressman Dan Goldman. And listeners, we're putting a call out, especially for those in the 10th Congressional District. Our phones are open. If you have questions for Congressman Goldman, the number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And Congressman Goldman, let's talk about Santos. The last time you were on this show, just after winning the general election, Congressman Santos was the guest right before you. And in that interview, he repeated some of his now debunked claims, like four of his employees died at the Pulse nightclub shooting. He also went on to say this about what he thought voters in his district wanted.
You know, transparency, accountability, these are things that Americans are looking for now. They want people held accountable. They want transparency. They want and they want accountability from Congress on top of good governance. And we need to deliver good governance in this next Congress and deliver an agenda that's going to be good for the people.
One of your first moves was to work with Congressman Richie Torres in the Bronx to file a complaint with the House Ethics Committee against Congressman Santos, as well as introducing legislation named the Santos Act, which stands for Stopping Another Non-Truthful Office Seeker. Congressman Goldman, when did you start digging into Santos and realizing that there were serious questions about his past?
Well, in mid-December, the New York Times had a bombshell report about all of his lies. And the thing that I, based on my, you know, training as a prosecutor, honed in on were his finances. Because, I mean, his lies about his ethnicity, his religion, his education, his employment, you know, are really startling and shocking. But part of the reason that we introduced that Santos Act is because those are not crimes. But what could potentially be a crime or a violation of ethics and in government, the act that prohibits members of Congress from lying about their campaign finance disclosures, that is where, you know, the true legal violations can lie. And so I really started digging in and looking closely at his financial statements, and there were, you know, red lights all over the place related to his campaign finances and his financial disclosures. And so that's why Congressman Torres and I referred his campaign finances to the Ethics Committee for an investigation. And of course, as we now know, federal criminal authorities are looking into the same financial conduct. You know, I think there are sort of two separate issues. One is just, you know, core basic ethics, and he wants to talk about transparency and accountability. It's, you know, the irony just screams out loud. He deceived his voters. He induced them to vote for him based on a web of lies. And that's enough for him to resign. But then there also may be violations of law that he should be held accountable for.
Congressman, are there any updates? I know the House ethics investigation process is confidential. It is lengthy. But is there anything new to tell listeners about since you initially filed that complaint?
Well, the big thing that jumps out to me is the reporting that the Department of Justice has asked the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, to stand down on its investigation of Santos, which, based on my experience working for the DOJ, occurs when there is an active ongoing criminal investigation that the department does not want to have any interference from other civil investigations. And so that's a clear indication to me that there is an investigation, a criminal investigation into George Santos. You know, the fact that Kevin McCarthy forced him to resign from his committees, or at least recuse, whatever he called it, recuse himself, is a clear indication that he, you know, the Republican leadership knows that George Santos defrauded his voters. There's no real explanation for why he should come off his committees but still remain in Congress. The same logic should lead him to resign fully from Congress. And so I do think that the pressure from the voters as well is starting to get to both, not just Santos, but to Kevin McCarthy, to Elise Stefanik, who was his biggest supporter. And we'll see what happens. You know, this is every day there's something new that comes out about him.
Well, that's right. And as you've mentioned some of the stuff that's come out this week, but I'll remind our listeners, you know, as you said, Santos said he would step down from his committee assignments. Politico reported yesterday that the FBI is investigating his role in that GoFundMe charity scheme connected to a veteran's sick dog. His campaign treasurer has fully resigned. Congressman Torres asked the Security and Exchange Commission to investigate some of Santos' business dealings in Florida. There are more. As a former prosecutor, when you see investigations happening on all these different tracks, do you think that Santos is holding on to his seat as a bargaining chip in case he does face criminal charges? And is that how long can a strategy like that last?
It's quite possible that he is doing that. You know, I think at the end of the day, Santos has no reason, you know, for himself to resign. But it is really incumbent upon the Republican leadership to make the decision as to whether or not they want to continue to embrace such a fraudster as part of their party and part of their conference in Congress. And so Santos may want to hold on, but at some point, one would hope that Republican leadership would not want to continue to support such a liar and a fraudster.
Finally, just as a member of Congress who is dealing with constituent issues, you've alluded to this, you know, the impact of what is happening here really is very much on the voters in Santos's district. There was that, of course, Senior College Newsday poll this week that found that more than 78% of voters polled in his district want him to resign. But as you said, Republicans have said the voters elected him. But now they're left with a half representative. I mean, can you speak to what you think the impact is on the voters?
Yeah, look, I think that rationale is quite ridiculous, actually. I mean, that's like saying that, you know, someone who lies on a bank loan application is absolved of guilt because the bank gave them the money. Well, the bank gave them the money because of the fraud, and George Santos got his votes because of his fraud. So, you know, it is quite indicative that over 60% of the voters who voted for him in that Siena poll that you referenced said they would not have voted for him if they knew the truth. And so that is a completely bogus explanation that doesn't stand up. If I were a voter in the 3rd District of New York, I'd be furious. A lot of our work happens in the committees. I'm on the Homeland Security Committee. You know, and one of the things that I've really started focusing on is the asylee crisis that New York City is facing. If I were not on that committee, I would not have the same access and the same ability to do that work. And so George Santos wanders around Congress doing nothing other than voting in support of Kevin McCarthy on whatever Kevin McCarthy puts forward. But he's unable to actually do the work for his district and for his voters that they sent him to do.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom in for Brian today. My guest is Congressman Dan Goldman. And Congressman, we're going to talk about that crisis with migrants here in New York in just a moment. But our lines are full of constituents and callers who want to speak with you. So let's go to Marvin in Brooklyn. Marvin, welcome to WNYC. You're on with Congressman Dan Goldman.
Hi, Bridget. Thank you for your work. And hi, Dan. The question I wanted to ask is, since you won the primary, you've been very active in terms of co-fundraising and helping elect Democrats. How do you see your role in terms of helping us recapture the House, and especially to make up for the seats we lost in New York State in this current election? And we're very proud of the job that you've been doing.
Thank you so much, Marvin. And it's a great question. I think there's a lot of energy and excitement within the Democratic caucus, notwithstanding the fact that we are in the minority. And we are all very focused on making sure that we take back the House in 2024. That is a key element of what we're doing, because as you can see from the first couple weeks of this Republican majority, they're not serious about actual legislation that can help the majority of American people, and certainly that will help the constituents in New York 10 in my district. They're much more interested in sort of fringe elements and sort of, you know, QAnon conspiracies and messaging resolutions that, you know, have no chance of becoming law. So we are very unified here in Congress, and we're very focused on making sure that we put our best candidates forward to flip the House again. I can tell you that the New York delegation has been spending a lot of time together talking about what happened in New York in the last election and figuring out a path forward to make sure that it does not happen again in the next election. And we're very supportive of each other, and we're very focused. And I think everybody in our New York delegation is very disappointed in the results in New York, which, you know, you could make a very good argument that there were enough close races that swung the majority to the Republicans. And one of the things that, you know, we need to emphasize is especially working together with not only the governor, but our local and state elected officials to make sure everyone understands that so many of our priorities within the city, within the state, hinge on federal funding. And if Democrats don't have the majority, we cannot get that federal funding for our priorities in the state. So it's not only something that we in Congress are focused on, but it's something that we as an entire state need to be focused on.
Well, that's a great setup for our next caller, Chaz in Manhattan. Chaz, welcome to WNYC. What's your question for Congressman Goldman?
Thank you. Appreciate your work, Congressman. I'm on the north side of 14th Street. Your district ends on the south side of 14th Street. Now that you're in the minority, how are you going to procure funds for the district, which, as you point out, needs infrastructure funds and new monies to handle a lot of problems? How as a minority member, do you procure funds for the district?
Well, Chaz, that's exactly the point. In the minority, it is very, very hard to get the funding for the programs that actually help Americans, help members, help you know, citizens of our city, of our state. We are lucky in some respects because the last Congress was so productive. And we have a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that was passed, and now some of that money is starting to be dispersed. I had the honor of joining President Biden on the Hudson Yards earlier this week, where there was an announcement of the first phase moving forward on the Gateway Tunnel underneath the Hudson River, which will really revolutionize rail traffic and, you know, provide much needed transport infrastructure support. So we are going to be focused on making sure that New York is getting as much of the money that has already been appropriated. But the reality is it's going to be very hard in the minority. This is why it stinks to be in the minority. And this is why it's so important that every Democrat recognizes how important it is for Democrats to be in the majority, Republicans are not interested in helping anyone other than their special interests and the wealthiest among us. And we as Democrats are consistently trying to fight for programs and policies that lift up underserved communities, that expand the middle class, that expand our tax base, provide jobs. And, you raise a great point, which is that we don't control what comes to the floor in the House. So it's very, very difficult in the minority to get new funding.
Chaz, thanks so much for your call. Congressman, I want to shift gears and talk about some federal issues at play here in your district. The city says since mid-January, nearly 30,000 migrants have come to the city seeking asylum and shelter. Mayor Eric Adams has repeatedly asked for more federal assistance and a federal solution to this issue. The newest shelter housing migrants here in the city is at the Brooklyn Cruise Terminal in your district. There have been protests over the conditions there, and Mayor Adams pushed back on those comments yesterday.
When I went to the Brooklyn Cruise Terminal, because you all know me, I like to go on the ground. I heard all of these complaints about no heat, no hot water, no food. And when I went there and saw that clean bathrooms, heat, warm, some people were wearing shorts and size, and the migrants and asylum seekers, what they said to me, they said, "Thank you, Mr. Mayor, we would like to work." And that's why I'm pushing to make sure that they're able to work. We did not hear one person there saying that they did not want to be there.
Congressman, have you been able to tour that facility yet? And if not, do you plan to?
No, I've actually been in Washington since it opened. But the first thing I am going to do when I touch ground this afternoon coming back from D.C. is to go directly there from the airport, because I also want to see it for myself. I think people need to understand what a massive undertaking this is. You know, we're not Texas. We're not these border states that basically don't provide any services or any support for asylees who come into this country. We are New York City, and we are treating these migrants and these asylees as we treat our own. And that is something we should be really proud of. But it also makes it a Herculean task to house 60,000 asylees who have come through already. And I do commend the mayor and his administration for working around the clock to do the very best they can in what is an incredibly difficult situation. And as I mentioned to the mayor when I saw him on Tuesday, you know, I am working on the federal level, working with the administration, trying to get funding, trying to get support. We are going to be trying to figure out a work authorization situation, because my experience in talking to these asylees when they come here is that they do want to work. And that's, you know, that's what they're hoping they can get. They have expertise from their own training that can be helpful to our city. And so, you know, we are all working together to not only try to house the asylees as they come in and have them live with dignity that every citizen of any country deserves, but also to try to get them to work so that they can help our economy.
Congressman, several of the individuals who were supposed to be housed in that facility have told my colleagues that the conditions there are inhumane. Is your office getting any reports about the conditions there?
Yes, we've been in regular contact. My office has been in regular contact with the Department of Emergency Services in the city, as well as the mayor's office. Our understanding is that the situation there is a little bit better than what was reported earlier this week, but is still not ideal by any stretch. And one of the reasons why I'm going there today is to see for myself exactly what is going on. But my office is in very close contact with everyone involved in this operation. And we want to make sure that we give adequate housing and support and shelter and food and, you know, access to everyone who comes into the city, while, you know, trying to solve this really, really difficult situation you know, from the top down as well.
You mentioned that part of what you'll be working for in Washington is to extend work authorizations so that some of these individuals can begin working and supporting, you know, earning a livelihood. Is there more that the federal government could be doing to deal with this immediate crisis? And do you have any hope for a more long-term solution?
Well, we have to figure out a longer-term solution. And, you know, part of that comes into, you know, part of that falls into some form of comprehensive immigration reform. I would very much like to see more asylum judges, more lawful visas, as part of any immigration reform that we move forward. We also just simply need funding from the federal government for all of these asylees that are coming into our city. And I, you know, I emphasized to the president this week when I saw him that New York City is treating these asylees so much better than anywhere else that they are treated. And we are providing them, you know, with dignified shelter and housing to the best of our abilities in the city. But we need federal help. And so we are working very hard to secure that and to try to figure out a more permanent solution for this crisis.
Let's go to some of our callers. Adam in Brooklyn, you're on the line with Congressman Dan Goldman.
Hi, Congressman. You're now on the House Committee on Homeland Security, which counts immigration policy among its responsibilities. But your name was conspicuously absent from the letter that over 70 of your Democratic colleagues in the House and Senate sent last week to President Biden calling for an end to Title 42. Title 42, it's not just bad policy. It's a violation of the due process rights that asylum seekers are entitled to under federal and international law. The courts have already found the policy to be arbitrary and capricious, a violation of the law on the day it was implemented, and even the rationalizations invoked then by Stephen Miller no longer apply. Title 42 is fundamentally based on the racist lie that asylum seekers carry diseases that pose a threat to Americans, and there's no justification for staying silent on it. I know you like to talk about how your grandmother found asylum in this country. When will you break your silence and join your colleagues in calling for an end to Title 42, rather than continuing to slam the door behind you on people who have just as much of a right to seek asylum in this country as your grandmother did?
Well, it's a great point. And we are, you know, actively trying to figure out a solution to replace Title 42. I certainly do not think that the Title 42 should continue to proceed. It's, you know, at this point, it's outdated. If the administration is going to end the public health emergency from COVID on May 11th, then Title 42 has absolutely no colorable basis. But we need to figure out, you know, a substitute, not necessarily to remove asylees, but to streamline the process and make sure that asylees get their due process rights, get their application heard expeditiously. Our system is just overrun right now. We don't have enough lawyers. We don't have enough immigration judges. We don't have enough employees who can process all of the paperwork, all of the applications, and even all of the lawful visa applications, which need to increase as well to allow people, more people, to come in legally, which will reduce the number of people who are trying to come in illegally. So we need comprehensive reform, and that will include, in my view, getting rid of Title 42.
We have one last caller that we're going to ask our final question. Laura in Warren, New Jersey. I know you have a question, which was going to be my last question, which is about the debt ceiling. But we only have a few seconds, so if you could make your question tight, that would be great.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. Yes, I'm a Democrat from New Jersey, and I'm very worried about the debt ceiling, leading to default. And I was hoping that the Democrats could reach out to Kevin McCarthy, who's, you know, obviously main priority is staying in his position rather than doing what's right for the country, to say, you know, we'll vote for you if you get to stay in your position if you bring up a debt ceiling increase without any strings attached to make that deal with him. What's wrong with making that deal and keeping him in his place? Because we can't elect a Democrat as Speaker anyway.
No, it's a good question that a lot of people certainly were asking in that first week. I think what everybody needs to realize is Kevin McCarthy is not a good faith actor, and he cannot be trusted. I think if he were willing to provide some concessions to Democrats, we could support him, but he would need to make sure that we get some of our bills to the floor and that we get something out of our support for him, because otherwise we are essentially propping up the Republicans in support of their extremist agenda. Kevin McCarthy and the Republican Party should do the right thing, which is to pay our past debts. If we want to talk about spending cuts and reducing the deficit moving forward, that is an entirely separate conversation, and it should be kept separate. But the reality is that the extremist Republicans want to eliminate our Social Security. They want to eliminate our Medicare, and we cannot allow that to happen. And so we're not going to be held hostage by the threats of pushing our country and our nation, I mean, our world, into an economic calamity.
We're going to have to leave it there for today. I've been speaking with Congressman Daniel Goldman, who represents the 10th Congressional District. Congressman, good luck on your travels and your visit to the Brooklyn Cruise Terminal today. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me, Bridget. Take care.